Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Let's talk about it from this perspective. Okay. What about a company that's been in the military contracting business that gets into commercial competitive electronics? How are they going to have to convert or something to that? However you want to frame it.
All right. Fine. Kirk, I started recording just before you launched into that. So I'm going to leave that as the opening and say, hey, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Shankler, and that was Kirk Gray. But the topic is, we were talking about just briefly that in the military type, and for a company that's making, a box for a military vehicle, they may be contracted to create this box at, they call it a cost-plus contract. And so
they're minimum bidder. You got to do the minimum bid, right?
Well, they bid on it, they win it, and they're going to spend money on components, on all these other pieces, and they're contracted to deliver it in 6 months. And so they have so many engineers, they get paid to pay their engineers, to pay their building a little bit, plus a modest profit. You know, I don't know what the numbers are, 5-10%, whatever it is, but they make a little bit to cover what's in the contract.
All right.
But I was working with a client that was in a circumstance like that, and they did not want to do any testing. They had contracted to make 10 units, and the contract only paid for 10 units. So if R54 was a unique resistor, they bought 10 resistors for R54. They didn't even have a budget or any plan to make a single prototype because it wasn't in the contract. They would come out of profit, and they had almost no profit in this. And I said, how do you make a living doing this? And he says, well, we make all our money in repairs. We're the only ones that can repair this system, and we can charge a much bigger profit. And and you had mentioned, but I think this idea is the wake-up call. Now, this company I mentioned, I worked with them years and years ago, they're out of business, is they could not create a reliable product over time, so the military procurement folks went found other people, other companies to make these boxes. They said, hey, you guys have a track record of making really bad products that don't last and aborts missions, it causes problems, it's a high cost of ownership, all this stuff. So we're going to go somewhere else. So the long term is they go out of business. Short term, they make money hand over fist repairing bad designs.
Exactly. Exactly.
But your notion there, Knight, is, or idea there is, well, what happens when, like the GPS manufacturers, they were military only for a while and then they got opened. And I don't know how many of them successfully transferred to the private sector to making. I don't know if Garmin and the other common GPS systems were military.
Trimble?
Primary.
Was that Trimble?
Yeah, I think Trimble was military.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think and anybody who has been in the commercial product development industry and or the opposite, been in the military industrial contractor culture, would immediately recognize the significant differences of it. One of the challenges that I've dealt with in the past is when a company that's been mostly a defense contractor and has made money off the aftermarket, and I've had individuals come up to me at accelerated stress testing conferences that I've been involved in and said, you know, this Halton Haas preventative idea of finding defects ahead before shipping it and improving the margins on it would be a lot easier to implement in our products if it wasn't for the fact that 60% of my program's profits come from spare parts and repairs. And I just kind of shake my head and I said, well, you know, you've got a real severe conflict of interest there, because making it reliable is making it less profitable for your company. And, you know, that's just a real bizarre orientation, because, of course, the guy, the company making a Tomahawk cruise missile, or the military buying it, can't go to the Walmart and buy the other alternative Tomahawk cruise missile. Well, you know.
Well, I don't know. Those Walmarts in Texas have a little bit of everything.
Yeah, right. I think they limit that to just mortars only. Yeah, okay. Anyway.
But yeah, but, I know what you mean. Is that I even when they recognize that it's a conflict of interest, is part of it is the military contracting process.
Right.
Is so restrictive on. Right. What they do during the development phase.
Sure, it's all top secret.
Well, not only top secret, is that they say, you know, you will do these procedures, but not those. And it might be you do FMEA, but you're not allowed to do HALT. We're not going to pay for that.
Right.
For whatever reason. As opposed to letting the design team make a system that has the lowest total over total cost of ownership. Right.
Right.
Now, a lot of the focus is on what's the function. Can it do what it's supposed to do? Right. And does it do it in our environment? Those kinds of things.
Right.
But I think part of the notion or part of the idea here is that some companies are, and it's not just military. There are companies that make money on spares and repair parts. Right.
Right.
And it is a viable business model. And I contend that it's in the short term. I think parts of the Yelp just the effect of everybody has a much louder voice now when something goes wrong or something goes right, that just because you make money on repairs doesn't mean customers are happy with having to send in products for repair.
Right.
And they will tell people, and they can tell thousands of people now.
And you really have to have something exceptionally technologically, or not have many competitors yet before, so that you don't really, the customer doesn't really have any alternatives, such as in the defense contracting industry. In a competitive environment, and you have a technological innovation, you may be able to get away with that. You may be able to get, you know, hey, it's a new technology, we expect failures. But as soon as another competitor enters the market and has done a better job of testing and removing the weak links in the product and produced a mature product at introduction, as you said, the social media, Yelp, all these places now make that communication very rapid. And immediately, if you start to have failures, especially, you know, dead on arrival type products and things like that, the world will know about it. It's in a competitive a consumer environment, especially.
Mm-hmm. Well, so if you're working as a reliability professional and you're working in one of these companies that makes money from spares and repairs, do you play the game and say, all right, well, it's not. No, you talked about the conference. I was sitting, I think I was at an ASTR conference. I was sitting next to a guy that made white appliances, the washers, dryers, dishwashers, refrigerators, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And we were chatting a little bit, and I didn't know this, but apparently those companies use more steel than the auto industry does. they're huge.
There's a lot of steel in washer and dryers. Yeah.
There is. And so these guys, and I said, you know, what you guys, I mean, why can't I buy a washing machine that lasts my lifetime? My grandmother's machine that she bought in the 50s, it's cast iron, right? Mm-hmm. And it has an on-off switch. It has one way to wash stuff. I mean, it has a big toggle switch, really. That's really all it has.
And that helps in reliability, reducing the parts.
Right. There is, you know... It was super heavy, so it wouldn't vibrate too much. A motor, a drum, you know, the water valves, and that was it. And he kind of looked at me and goes, well, that's not a good business model. He said, your grandmother's not a good customer. She bought one machine and we never saw her again. And so we don't want to make them so good that they last forever, because once we sell everybody a washing machine, we only can sell at the rate of the people buying houses or apartments.
Well, that's right. And that's a conflict. That's a problem, especially for the marketing or whatever, the future sales. And I have seen this in actual reality happen where I used to sell helium mass spectrometers, which were used for vacuum leak detection. Mm-hmm. And the new model was tiny and portable that they had developed. And they had this big, bulky one that passed leak detector. It even had tubes in it, mm-hmm. but it was reliable. It worked forever. Mm-hmm. And so they introduced this new model, and it was even better, easier, more convenient, had a lot of features. But, you know, the people I went to said, well, we want one of those older, you know, ones you made 10 years ago because they never break. And so it was really hard to sell into the market when you had such – in fact, they even decreased the sensitivity or the capability of the new model so that they wouldn't just obliterate their current, you know, the other desktop or floor top model of leak detector. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I agree, but I think the motivation shouldn't be necessarily that – in fact, it's a very bad – to me, a very bad bet is that your customer will accept a failure of a system breaking and buy your same product. Or, you know, if there's competitors, they may consider another product depending on the duration. And, of course, 15 years or 10 years for a washing machine is a long time. But
Well, that's where they did the studies. I mean, and they're not.
Yeah.
I don't think they were foolish. Yeah. I think there's a warranty on the main parts of a washing machine for 10 right. years, mm-hmm. right? And they have a pretty good sense that they'll last about 11 years, not on average, but
right.
the wear out of the motors, the bearings, the amount of vibrations, the system. This thing's going to start taking itself apart after about 10 years, and then the rate of failures will go right. up, such that most of them will fail in by 15 years.
Right. But I think with technological.
So okay. what they're saying is that what their studies found is that if a customer has a brand for 10 years, mm-hmm. they're very likely to buy the same brand because of the positive experience they had right. for the last 10 years. Right. And so they watch that very closely. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, well, if that changes, we'll make it last 15 years. But what they mm-hmm. did is they took out all the weight for shipping costs, mm-hmm. which made it more likely to vibrate. They took right. they added more electronics for add more right. features, which right. increased the chances of failure. But they're right. very careful that it has very low failure rate out to 10 years. And then right. it's a very sharp increase in failure rate.
Okay.
So it's very close to a perfect product that lasts 10 years in a day.
Right.
You know?
Right. But I think that the bigger motive or a better goal for a manufacturing company or a design company is to, like Apple does, add, you know, every model from the iPhone 4, 5, 6. Of course, Apple built in a mechanism for absolute wear out, which is a battery. The rest of the product will last for years beyond the battery life. But yeah. Providing a technological advantage, like, for instance, when we bought this house, okay, one of the things is I have never seen a high-efficiency washing machine, but it's a huge advantage. It's very complex in the fact that it has this very much more complex wash sequence and cycle to use much, much less water.
Mm-hmm.
And I found, you know, not that I chose it, but I can see where if I had an old washing machine and was about to wear out 7 years, the technological innovation that this new high efficiency washing machine has come about is probably enough reason to maybe replace my machine. So, you know, the motivation instead of having it wear out is to buy such a proposition to the customer that they'll get these many more benefits, like a car nowadays with a reverse
backup
camera.
Cameras,
camera. Yeah. I, that's a huge safety and advantage that makes me, even though my Lexus is not worn out yet, I see the advantages plus USB and iPod connections inside and all the other advantages of safety, airbags everywhere and the sides and the and the, you know, well, double, side airbag.
Yeah, double check who makes the inflators for those things first. But you wrote an article on your blog about the drain in the bathtub curve. And you were talking about this, that the technology
obsolescence.
Yeah, that it creates a compelling reason to get rid of the old one and keep a new buy a new one.
Right.
You know, it's my laptop and phone. I would love to keep them both for 10 years. They work. I can do write articles. I can view websites. I can make replace phone calls. I can do whatever I need. But they're going to come out with updates to the operating system. They're going to change the speed of these things. They're going to change the graphics capability.
Memory capacity? Look, you can buy a 2-terabyte drive now. I mean, it's just phenomenal for us that have been in the industry for 25 years to hear about a 2-terabyte drive and a little 3.5-inch form factor is just at phenomenal, the compression that they're able to do.
It's amazing. Yeah. But every product has a different time frame. And part of it is what do we use it for and what's the technology improvement. iPhone guys have been accused of slowing down the rate of innovation. It's not been that dramatic from the 5 to the 6, for example. And so there's been some disappointment. But I think every product goes through that cycle where there's an early period where there's lots of great innovations and inventions and the market then matures. I don't want it to change too much because I don't want to have to relearn how to use it, right?
Well, yes, as I get older, I'm more happy with the old ways, you know, even though I know, you know, like texting and things like that, it's, I guess I exposed my age that I'm getting used to those things, but I'm being forced into it.
Now back to this, the military guys. And I think the piece I caught right at the start was, well, what happens when you are fundamentally changing your business model is from going to, we make money on spares and repairs to it's got to last 10 years with a low failure rate.
Because, and we're going to make money on producing models and new innovations that will make the customer want to buy the new product before our old product wears out or he starts problems.
Right. So for the reliability folks is, well, what is that innovation roadmap? So if it's every 5 years or every 2 years or every 10 years, that's our target. That's our duration for the reliability goal. And then it's, what can we do technology-wise and capability-wise to minimize failure rate over that time. But it's right away, though, we're talking about business objectives, market expectations, brand loyalty, customer satisfaction. You know, that's not in our toolbox of HALT and HAST and ALTs.
No. And the process, you know, and also future technological innovations. You never know when somebody's going to come up with a game-changing type of invention that, you know, maybe even makes your product line obsolete. I can't think of anything offhand, but.
Well, buggy whips kind of suffered that to a big degree. But the notion...
And slide rules,
Yeah. I wish I would have kept my slide rules.
I know.
It'd be cool whip that out in a class sometime.
Can you see the guys at the slide rule company see the first handheld calculator and say, oh, no, that'll never fly. They'll never get to logarithmic calculations or anything like that.
Yeah, I'm sure it was for about 3-4 years. And then... But Polaroid, right? They kept making cameras.
Instant.
There's plenty of stories like that. But the notion, I think I keep wanting to say the notion, but the idea here is that as we work as reliability professionals, it has to fit into the business structure of what we're working with.
Right.
So even a company that's making money on spares and repairs, there is a risk that if you're not reliable enough, you're going to lose the business altogether.
That is true.
So there's still a threshold that it might not be your top priority. It might not be the biggest thing. But you can also make more money if you make doing the repairs easier, right? If you have good diagnostics, if you have good access to the repairs, that's all still reliability work.
Minimizing
the cost of ownership is a big piece of this. So I don't think that the way, at least here in the U.S., the military contractors have to work in the environment is bad or evil. I think there's problems with it. It drives an inappropriate behavior, I think, in my opinion. But it is what it is.
It's a long-term culture that has been developed over many decades, okay? Yeah. So it's not going to change real quickly. And it's not really a short-term competitive environment like consumer electronics and the general a very large quantity of the market. So that's a big factor. But, talking about ease of repair and things, well, in the future podcast, maybe we'll get into I've gotten into pinball machine reliability.
Oh, really?
Talk to some manufacturers of that, and I'll talk about that. But that's an interesting machine that has a lot of mechanical electronics in it, and it's a high maintenance system. I've got to get in touch with Stern Pinball and see how they actually test. But anyway, it's an interesting field that we can talk about in the future.
All right.
But I think the market is really, especially in the consumer, it defines expectations of reliability. And in the military and the defense contracting environment, that's just a very different world. And I think anybody that's been in both will tell you that for sure.
Yeah. Well, there's still work to be done. We still need to understand failure mechanisms, make things safe. We need to all the many different tools we have still apply when done well.
Right.
And different set of barriers or constraints to making that happen.
Correct.
But it is so let's ask our listeners, if you're in one of these environments where you're pretty much ignored because we don't want it to work, we want it to fail so we can make money to really oversimplify it.
Yeah.
Well, what do you do? How do you still create a reliable system that meets your end customers' requirements and expectations? You know, how do you overcome that kind of barrier in culture and still do a good job? We'd love to hear from you on that. If you have a really good story, we'll get you on the show and kind of pick your brain as to how you made that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find the episode over at reliability.fm. And underneath the Speaking of Reliability podcast series. And by the way, there's 4 shows now in the Reliability.fm podcast network. We just added Rooted in Reliability. It's by James Kovacek, and he talks about asset management and plant maintenance type of aspects of reliability. And the show's been doing really well. I'm kind of getting jealous. And Kirk, I noticed this when you publish an article on the site.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It does way better than my articles. and when, when somebody else posts, you get 400 or 500 visits and I get typically 100. And so it's like, it's my veiled way of saying, hey, you should post more often, but it's, I've been heavily involved with the 3 shows, this one, Speaking of Reliability, Dare to Know, and the Ascendo webinar series, which is really a recording of our webinar series. But the Rooted in Reliability is our first addition to the network, and I'm very, very happy that it's doing well. So if you as the listener are in the world of plant maintenance and asset management, you might want to check that podcast out. Give it a listen. It's a mix of monologues where he talks about particular topics or concepts and interviews. And Kirk, you get a kick out of it as he interviewed me about no MTBF. So we had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah. That's just a start for me.
So anyway,
pushing back. Yeah.
That's right. So anyway, that's the show for today. Thanks for listening and do let us know what you think. And we'd love to hear from you if you're facing and have successfully overcome this culture of, well, we make money on the aftermarket.
Yes. Feedback helps us make it a better podcast. So we'd love to hear what you have to say and what you guys think of it.
All right. Well, thanks, Kirk. We'll wrap it up there.
Thank you, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.